Hello, August.
Hello, Pete. And hello, everyone who's listening. This is the Ode to Resilience, a podcast about the Cyber Resilience Act, the European Union's premier digital product regulation. And I'm August Bornique. I am a CRA consultant who is also a U.S. attorney by profession and recently was working as one of the rapporteurs, special rapporteurs on the standardization effort for the CRA. And this is my co-host, Pete DeVere.
Yep. So I'm Pete. I am also a CRA consultant. I am, contrary to August, not a lawyer, but an electrical engineer and also a member of the EU or the European Commission's expert group on the CRA. So today, August, we will be talking about RDPS, but
we put it off long enough.
We have put it off long enough.
This is a serious subject that eventually we knew we'd have to get to.
Indeed, and I believe that we have teased the audience for long enough. Sure. However, we will tease them slightly longer because before we get into that, we have a couple of short news items. The first one, which I believe is very much in your ballpark, and that is that all ETSI vertical standards are now out for public review. What does that mean exactly?
So what this means, this is true. This is a very exciting milestone in the CRA standardization effort. What this means is that the final, and I was just doing air quotes there because this is not final, but the complete drafts for all of the vertical standards for the CRA, that is the ones that are covering different market segments, different kinds of products, they are out. And they have been approved by the larger ETSI bodies to go to public comment. And I do want to say really quickly that public comment is not necessarily public comment, but it is sort of public. It means that the national bodies for the various EU member states will now be producing comments on these standards and suggestions of how to fix them or make them better for their final, true final iteration. What I think is important here for listeners and for people who are not members of a national body is that you can go to ETSI's website and you can find a copy of these drafts. You can read them yourself. You can also, I don't know exactly how because it's going to be dependent on your particular member state, but many of the public bodies that have been, that it's their job to provide comment on this, are soliciting comments from the broader public. So there is still time to have your say.
Yeah, and I can also say that if you want to figure out how to comment on these documents, you can go to LinkedIn and look for Stefan Zimmermann from VDMA, and he has a very good post where he has information about how you can read these public drafts, which in the case of ETSI standards is actually quite easy because they're on the website, but also how you can comment on them through your national standards body. So the way this would then work is that you provide comments to the national standards body, and then the working group in the national standards body that's responsible for these standards, they will take in all of the public comments, and then they will decide which of those comments they want to incorporate in the national comments on the standard. And that then goes back to ETSI, and then ETSI needs to process all of these comments. And actually, I believe, August, you might know this better than me, but that for every single comment that comes in through this public comment or inquiry phase, as it's called in the lingo, ETSI actually needs to then argue why they will accept or reject a comment.
Yes, that is what will happen. I think, again, there's a space to talk about how to write a good comment. The gist of it is specifics. Take a look at the standard you're looking at, and if you see a specific sort of technical requirement or assessment criteria that doesn't match with how you as an expert in a particular product area work and what the best practices are, let that be known and always provide alternative phrasing. Don't just say, this isn't good, or how could you do this, or this needs to be rewritten to reflect whatever ISO standard you love. That will be ignored, and it will be justifiably ignored. And I say that as someone who has gotten similar comments when we were doing full public open commenting. And it's not that those are bad comments. It's not that those are bad ideas necessarily. It's that this has already been worked on for a year and the baseline is set. But the details are not, and the details are super important.
Yeah.
Because so they are the technical requirements that.
So if you have comments and you want your comments to be taken into account, it would be really helpful if you actually propose a very specific change to the document. And I believe that in the all of the various ways that there are for commenting on these standards at the national level, there's always a section where you can write your comment, but then also a section where you can write the proposed change. And in the best case, that proposed change is really like one sentence that you propose to replace by another sentence. One more comment, because we were only talking about the Etsy verticals, but there are actually also verticals that are not written by Etsy. Do you know anything about those, August?
I do not know anything. I believe there's a couple Senelec verticals. Those tend to be the ones that are, for whatever reasons, are not quite as in the public eye. I think you're talking about some of the stuff that's, you know, operational technology and things like that. I do not know how to, I haven't seen anything on those. I haven't been following those as well.
Yeah. So in general, the documents coming out of Senelec are a bit harder to get your hands on. I also have to admit that I'm not fully following the various timelines of all the various verticals. But if you're interested in these, keep an eye on what your national standards body is putting out for public review, which, to be honest, it's probably easier to keep an eye on what people are posting on about on LinkedIn. But you could also have a look at the Stanford CRA website, so stanfordcra.eu, which actually lists all of the standards that are being worked on and gives you some indication of where they are being worked on and what their status is. The information is not always super easy to find and not always super up to date, but that's probably your best entry point if you're interested in this.
The BSI also had a dashboard for a little while. I don't know if they're keeping it up still, of where each of the standards are and, you know, what stage and things like that. So if your German is good, you might go to the BSI website and see if you can find that.
So talking about the BSI, that actually brings us perfectly to our second news item, which is about the new technical guidance about the CRA that the BSI just brought out. That's technical guidance TR03183-1, which talks about cyber resilience requirements for manufacturers and products, part one, general requirements, which is a very extensive document, which I have not yet had the time to fully read because it's, again, it's about 80 pages.
I mean, it's also August, Pete. I mean, we're not supposed to work in August. I mean, that when I immigrated to the EU, I was promised vacation time. So I as well have not delved deeply into the technical guidance from the BSI. I've heard great things about it, though. It's apparently, you know, an amazing ride, just absolutely stunning, totally worth reading, you know, better than the Odyssey.
One thing that I find quite interesting, though, is that we're getting a guidance document from the European Commission, but then also we're getting guidance from the BSI. And potentially we'll be getting some guidance from the RDI, that's the Dutch, and then potentially from 25 other member states. And then there will be some guidance from ENISA as well. Right? That's a lot of guidance. And at some point, probably some of that guidance is going to be contradictory on some points.
I think we've already reached that point.
I think at some point we might need some guidance on the guidance in order to figure out how to get around all of these documents. Because
Doesn't that get us to the sort of fundamental core difficulty with guidance, which is that it's not controlling? The guidance is really helpful. Like, you know, what the EC thinks of the law that was just passed is quite helpful to know, and it's probably going to carry the day as to the interpretation. But the interpretation is yet to happen, and we will not know for sure whose interpretation wins out for several years, maybe. Until the courts have really chewed on it for a while, I would say. Because that's where, in the end, that's where the decision is going to be made. So guidance is great, but take it with a grain of salt, I guess. A very small grain.
The commission guidance is also very clear about this. It's actually one of the first things that's in there that says that this guidance is just that, it's guidance. It's not actually authoritative. And the only people that can really decide what the law says are the courts. Talking about guidance, there is more guidance. ENISA released the final version of their Secure by Design and by Default playbook, which before was out in draft, which is also guidance and is interesting because there's a lot of very interesting stuff in there. But to me, it's not yet quite clear how this document slots in exactly with all of the other guidance and with the standards and with the exact legal obligations, because I believe that this document is also quite clear in saying that it is non-binding, or it's really just a suggestion as to what a company or what an organization might do in order to build secure products. So yeah, again, there we're really seeing this question. We have all of this guidance, but it starts becoming difficult to make sense of all of the different guidance. So
I feel like we have a last bit of guidance on recent guidance, but then you've just reminded me, I have a controversial statement about guidance. Let's talk about this. There's one more thing that came out recently, right?
There is one more thing that's not called guidance, but effectively it is kind of guidance. And that is that INISA published or updated their FAQ on the single reporting platform. And they also published a fact sheet. And people seem to not be able to shut up about it. Do you have opinions on that, August?
I mean, I think the whole reporting platform thing is, it reminds me, I worked for the US government briefly when they were rolling out a new data warehousing project. And it was impossible to use, and everyone was having trouble using it, and no one knew what to do. And it was such a tragic nightmare for a week. And then people kind of figured it out, and some of the bugs got fixed, and 3 months later, no one cared. And I think I'm hoping that this is the same for the Common Reporting Platform, that there's going to be bugs and problems and difficulties at first, and it's going to take some time to work through them. But being afraid of those and being worried that if you happen to be the first person who has to report your severe incident or exploited vulnerability on the Common Reporting Platform and you get it wrong, I really doubt that you're going to be subject to a fine or even an investigation, especially if the problem is the reporting platform. So, you know, it'll get worked out in the end. I'm kind of nonplussed about it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of drama being made about not that much at the moment online. And that holds both for the reporting requirements in general, where you see a lot of disinformation and people predicting all sorts of doom, which I don't really see a reason for. And then also regarding the reporting platform, INISA is getting a lot of criticism for the way they communicate and what they communicate and what they do not communicate and when the platform will be available and what features it will have and whatnot. To be honest, I think they're doing a pretty good job. Would it be better if the platform were available earlier? Yes. Are there certain features that the platform could have that would be good? Probably also yes. Will all of this matter in the end? Probably not. So to everybody who is thinking about this platform or about the Article 14 requirements, I'd say, calm down, it's all going to be fine. And we actually plan to do an episode just about Article 14 and the reporting requirements very soon. So yeah, More about that then.
So this brings me to my controversial opinion about guidance. And this is something I've noticed in a lot of a bunch of open source efforts to sort of create guidance themselves on how to comply with the CRA or how to think about open source software stewardship. There are for-profit guides all over the internet. I think most of them are just horrible ChatGPT or whatever, algorithmically written, derived junk. But everyone has something to say about how to comply with the CRA. Everyone wants to give you guidance right now. And part of my take on that is that this is because seizing the sort of high ground in arguing what the interpretation of a particular part of the CRA is right now allows one to have influence, because the courts do not have a full-blown idea of what the CRA means yet. I suspect that they have not read it for the most part, because they're very busy people. At least in the US, that's what the case would be. So by getting interpretations out there and getting ideas out there about what the CRA means, the reason there's so much of that is because people are pushing their own views. I won't say agendas, because I think most of the time these views are being offered for generally positive reasons, trying to make sense of this incredibly complex regulation. So that's my controversial statement on guidance.
Yeah, I think I actually largely agree with that. because you were talking about the courts, but I think also in the executive branch, there's a bunch of people that have been, or a bunch of people in a number of EU member states that have been looking at the CRA quite closely for quite a long time. But there's also a bunch of member states that really do not have such a good understanding yet of what the law means. And then with member states, I mean governments in those member states that really are not that familiar with the CRA. It's also something that is very apparent when you're talking to these member states. You know, some of them you can have really deep discussions about or with about certain aspects of the CRA. And then sometimes you hear representatives of a member state ask questions which are really beginner's questions, and that many, many people, or that the answers are quite well established for by now. So you really, like, it definitely is possible to sway the interpretation of the law still. And some people will do that for very positive reasons. We should also not forget that there's a lot of people there that just want to sell their services, and that's easier if there's a panic. And I think when you look on LinkedIn, most of the stuff that you see is actually related to that. Anyway, I think I just made some enemies, so maybe that's...
Well, you know, you made enemies of whatever AI slop is appearing on LinkedIn right now, so I think that puts you on the side of good. Because nobody loves that stuff. Nobody likes seeing that stuff. But Pete, since we're talking about controversial topics and we're making these bold controversial statements like, please stop filling my feed with AI slop, you had one that I thought was pretty good that I think can really launch our discussion of what this topic we're talking about today is, which is remote data processing and whatever that is in the CRA. So why don't you tell me that and tell our audience that as well?
I will lead with my hot take. So in a bit, we're going to read the definition of RDPS, and then we're going to go in all sorts of depths talking about what the various parts of the definition mean. And my hot take is that the definition of RDPS actually doesn't really matter. I'll just leave that there for now. We can jump into the definition and talk it through. And then
Ominous. I think that is perfect. Just let that stand. It's such a bold statement. It's like standing like just a monolith at sunset, just casting a shadow over the rest of this podcast. It's amazing.
Are you sure you're a lawyer? Because that sounds very artsy.
You know, every lawyer is a frustrated, I don't know what that would be. You know, like a bad 19th century poet. It's something like that.
I'm actually reading a book right now in which there's a character called August, who is an artist, bit of a tormented artist. So I'm like, the assimilation between real life August and book August is becoming stronger now.
I mean, something that has been tormenting me for the past year is remote data processing.
Okay, let's get to that, and let's get to the definition. I have my printed copy of the CRA.
All right. Do you want to do the honors from 3.2? Are we looking at 3.2 here?
I think let's start with the mother of all CRA definitions, and that's the definition of product with digital elements. For our readers with very good memory,
half of last episode on that definition. So go back, listen to that again.
So let's start with product with digital elements, because the definition of that explains why we care about remote data processing solution at all. So products with digital elements, according to the CRA, means a software or hardware product and its remote data processing solutions, including software or hardware components being placed on the market separately. So what this definition really says is that a product with digital elements, in the way that it's used in the CRA, it includes the remote data processing solution as part of the product. So it's not that you have a product and then next to that you have an RDPS. No, it's the RDPS is part of the product.
As much as the hardware or the software. It's really just a third category of stuff that can be part of a product or that can be a product. I would love to read Article 3.2, again, we're looking at the definition section of the CRA, and I would just recommend anyone, when you're looking at a legal document, find the definition section first. It will help you. I didn't do that when I was reading the CRA. I was very confused for the first hour. Article 3.2, remote data processing, means data processing at a distance for which the software is designed and developed by the manufacturer or under the responsibility of the manufacturer, and the absence of which would prevent the product with digital elements from performing one of its functions.
That is a lot.
There's a lot there. I think there's really kind of, I don't know, maybe three big ideas there.
Yeah. And I would actually go ahead and throw in a fourth, which is
which is completely screwing up our preparation
for this podcast, because we had three of them listed before and now I bring a fourth. So we'll see how good
we do this every time. There's a secret fourth part to every definition. So what are the simple three, the three that you will find everywhere?
Let's start with the three that you'll find everywhere. That is that according to the definition, for something to be an RDPS, it needs to have the software designed and developed by the manufacturer or under the responsibility of the manufacturer. That's one. Then the absence of this processing must prevent the product from performing one of its functions. That's two. And then three is that the processing must be at a distance.
And all of those are quite subject to interpretation.
We could probably talk an hour about each one of those bullets.
Oh, yeah. Especially if we go into the various historical permutations over the last year of what people thought that meant last June and what they thought in May and how it's evolved. Because this is one of the topics within the Cyber Resilience Act that has been constantly evolving, and the ideas have been shifting around and they've been debated, and there's been a lot of, I won't say there have been heated arguments, but there have been arguments about what this means.
My fourth point is actually somewhat of an illustration of that. Should we start with that one and keep it short?
Yeah. I'm excited. I don't even know what you're going to say. So okay. you're just really pulling this out of a hat. It's great. Yeah.
So when you read the definition in Article 3.2, it says that remote data processing solutions means data processing at a distance for which the software is designed and developed by the manufacturer or under the responsibility of the manufacturer. So it's processing for which the software is designed by the manufacturer. When you read the Commission's guidance, it says that RDPS only consists of software. So it says that hardware cannot be part of the RDPS, which is something that I do not read in this definition. It says data processing for which the software is designed by the manufacturer, but in my head, that does not exclude the fact that there could be non-software components that are part of the RDPS. Whereas the Commission guidance clearly states that the RDPS only covers software.
And this is a new kind of twist for me as well. And I think it's interesting that it's coming from you, Pete, because you're in the world of hardware. And I can certainly imagine a situation where you would have some kind of specialized piece of hardware that was developed to perform a function of a product at a distance. I don't know what that would be exactly, but I would hope something was making sure that chunk of hardware was secure, you know? It is sort of in the guidance, it's focusing on software, because I think from the beginning, RDPS has been kind of seen as cloud computing. Generally, if you were going to ask someone, give me an example of an RDPS, most people working in the CRA space, the first thing they would say would be like the cloud attached to an app or cloud storage or something like that. And not looking at these sort of specialist hardware creations.
To make sure that we don't make this too long, I will just go ahead and say that in almost all cases that you will ever encounter as a manufacturer, this point that I just raised is going to be highly theoretical and academic, and you should probably not care about it. So let's just leave it at the fact that I do not necessarily agree with what's in the guidance and move on to the three points that are less disputed or that are actually more relevant.
And I think this, again, also gets back to your original point of maybe the definition of RDPS doesn't matter as much as people think. So let's move on to the one of these that I always place first, because I just think it's the easiest point to start from, which is the remote data processing, the absence of which prevents the product digital elements from performing one of its functions, and what that means, and what is that even talking about?
The interesting thing is that this notion of the functions of the product, it's present in the definition that we just read. It's also very present in the Commission guidance. However, nowhere, neither in the CRA legal text nor in the Commission guidance, is it actually explained or formally defined what exactly counts as a function of a product and what does not. There are some hints that you could try to interpret a definition out of, but the definition itself is remarkably absent. So maybe we can start with some examples of things that on which there is consensus whether they are functions of the product or not.
So for me, function, and I think this discussion of function, and I think the focus on function, obviously it's in the CRA when it comes to RDPS, but it has been a constant and primary concern when talking about vertical standard creation. Because the vertical standards, each and every one of them, is based on a product category. So you have a network management system. Well, how do you define a network management system? The EC has created a definition of that, but ultimately what you're talking about is products that do a bunch of different things, and many of those might be what network management system does. So you can say the product has the functions of a network management system, but maybe it also has the functions of firewall, et cetera, et cetera. So you have a lot of this discussion around what is an essential function of the product, what is an ancillary function of the product, and how you're going to regulate that, how you're going to assess a product with many different, that does many different things. So I think, in a way, to me, when I see function, it's pretty intuitive to me. It just is a thing that the product, an intentional activity that the product engages in. So
the problem with things that are intuitive is usually that they are intuitive until you get to the edge cases.
Right? Exactly.
Although I guess that's always true. That's also true for things that are fairly strictly defined.
No, you're entirely correct. I mean, that was kind of one of the places I was going to go with this, which is that the entirety of RDPS and defining RDPS is about getting really confused by the edge cases.
Yeah. Should we, maybe before we go into the edge cases, should we start by stating what clearly is a function or is not a function of a product?
Go for it. You clearly state what is a function or is not
a function. Okay, I will.
My personal function shibboleth.
Yeah, probably some people are going to email us afterwards and say that we got it all wrong and show us edge cases that...
Would it be an RDPS discussion if someone didn't think we'd gotten it all wrong and wasn't particularly aggrieved by this?
Probably not. Okay, so things that I believe are very obviously functions of a product or things that support a function of a product. The first one is everything that has to do with remote control. So let's say that you are selling a coffee maker, and for some reason you have decided that it must be possible for someone to start the coffee maker by pressing a button on a web page. So you, as the manufacturer of this product, you create a web interface through which you can manage your coffee maker that includes a button that says make coffee. That is a function of the product. And if that server, system, web page, thing, whatever you want to call it, if that would be absent, then that function of remotely starting the coffee maker would no longer function or would no longer work. Therefore, this system that is used for that is going to be an RDPS, even if there is also a button on the coffee maker itself that you can press. So the presence of a local backup option or redundant, like the ability to do something both locally and do it remotely, that does not make the remote option not a function. Do you agree with that, August?
Yeah, I think that's a very important aspect of it, and one that was actually subject to some debate, at least within the standard space and also within the guidance space. Another aspect of that I think that is interesting, though, is specifically having on this coffee maker, for example, if you had a horrible coffee maker that you could only make coffee by logging into the coffee app, maybe going onto their whole coffee social media platform and, you know, doing whatever, and that was the only way you could make coffee, you would have a product that was much more fragile and much less functional, and also probably not nearly as compliant with the essential security requirements as if it also just has a button or a switch that you can say, oh, turn on brewing now from, you know, with your finger. Because that backup itself can become a mitigation for the failure of the RDPS.
So in general, I would agree, but I'm not sure if I would agree for the coffee maker. Because the argument that you seem to be making there is that the local button is a inherent countermeasure to protect against the incident that because the RDPS is unavailable, the coffee making functionality is not available.
Right. And obviously, I mean, obviously the CRA is not necessarily concerned that you design your product to work well.
No, because also if you are, if you're doing a risk assessment and you need to assess how severe it is that someone cannot make coffee, I would probably rate it as quite low severity. So that's not going to be a high risk. So that's a risk that you might be able to accept. However, if instead of talking about a coffee machine,
we were talking about SIEM systems, perhaps we were talking about logging security incidents on your network.
Yeah. Or I was thinking about, it's actually a little bit tricky to find a good example here, but I was thinking about something like maybe some form of alarm system. An obvious case would be a medical device, but medical devices are not in scope. So maybe something that looks like a medical device, but isn't, something where if the product does not work, that actually can be quite dangerous.
Your Internet of Things nuclear reactor.
Your Internet of Things nuclear reactor. That's
for your Jetsons lifestyle, the one that you just keep under your sink, you know.
If the functionality to lower your control rods in that thing, if that can only be done remotely and then that functionality is not available, that would be quite a significant risk that would warrant a local override.
Anyways, we kind of wandered off
second,
there.
Yes. But second example of obvious RDPS. That is, let's say that you have a photo app which runs locally on a phone, but to store the photos, it actually uses, or to back up the photos, it uses a web server that you have, as a manufacturer, have implemented software for yourself. And so it's using this web server as remote data storage for the app. And clearly, this remote data storage server will support a function of the product. Because if that remote data processing service is not there, then the user can potentially no longer view their photos or no longer backup their photos. Another example, software update. So installing software updates is a function of the product. So if your software update server is unavailable, that's a function of the product that is not available. A counterexample of something that's not a function of the product would be your website on which you host the user manuals of your product. And assuming that that's just a basic static website that has a PDF file, which is a copy of the user manual.
Pete, when you talk about updates, I'm reminding something. This was something that I had suppressed like a childhood trauma, actually, because it was a very, very intense discussion that went on for a while about updates and secure update. And sure, if you have an automatic update that just, you know, your phone downloads things that break it in the middle of the night and then you have to buy a new iPhone, maybe that was the trauma. I'm not sure. That obviously is a remote data processing solution because it is something that is fully under the manufacturer's control. But what if you have a operating system that's, say, reasonably open source or very open source, but still wants to comply with the CRA, and all those updates are manual? There's a website out there that you can go to that's the official website of the organization that produces this product or project, and you can click a button and download the latest security update or download the latest update. That isn't an RDPS, I would argue. But how you draw that distinction is very tricky.
Yes.
Because the function that it's performing is updating the security, but maybe that's not a function of the product. That's clearly that's something the user has to do manually. And yeah, I mean, secure update is its own. Maybe we could have a whole episode about secure update, couldn't we?
We most certainly could. Is this, August, where you're very strong intuitive feeling breaks apart when we talk about software update?
It's where very smart people who are very close to various products have given me an earful. At the same time, I also think you would not want to be releasing a product that had manual update, even if that was something that the product could have, and there's certain requirements for certain types of products that may not be possible, that had manual update, and then not have a secure thing to update off of. You know, anybody can post
secure
an update.
Here, you mean available or?
I mean a website that some random person with ill intentions can't be like, yep, here's the new security update. I've just injected it into your queue of you know, brand new.
I think there's two things here that would prevent that. And first of all, even if the website for which you're providing the security updates would not be an RDPS, then the risk that somebody would install a malicious security update onto a product would still be a product level risk that you would need to implement some product level mitigations for. For example, you could use signed updates. And if you do that well, then for the integrity and authenticity of the update, the channel through which the updates are delivered no longer matter. But then also, I would argue that there would still be an availability requirement on this website as well, because there is this requirement for manufacturers to keep updates available for, 10 years after they are released or till the end of the support period, something like that. And then you could also argue about whether an availability of the website that hosts the updates would be a product level risk.
Update is something that we could talk, have a whole episode about. It's a very, very complex product function because it is so connected to security. It is so connected to product lifecycle. It is so connected to the point at which the product is no longer the product anymore.
So let's close this tangent.
Let's put that one in the corner and just pretend it's not there.
So example of things that are functions are remote control, remote data processing, software update. Something that's not a function is a website that hosts a user manual. Something that we can discuss about endlessly is a website that hosts a software update, even though I think we agree that that's probably not RDPS, but
yeah, it's probably not RDPS, which of course gets back to the original point, which is maybe the definition of RDPS doesn't matter because the product still needs to be secure. And there's other ways that these sort of remote inputs, these services, remote services is the phrase that I like using, need to be protected. Have requirements around them. So
a similar point would be around telemetry, where the guidance actually lists telemetry exactly or specifically.
Well, let's read the guidance. Why don't we read the guidance on that? Because I think it's very specific and very interesting language, actually, if you happen to have it.
Scroll to it.
Was it 193? 192.
It talks about something that is not explicitly not RDPS, and then it says this includes, for example, remote analysis of telemetry data collected purely for statistical purposes or future product development.
And the reason this one is interesting to me is because this is an example that has been being kind of in and out of the guidance and in discussion. I won't say it's in and out of the guidance, but it's been in discussion. And I personally find this kind of a questionable bit of guidance, because there's one way of reading it that says the remote analysis of the telemetry data is not a function of the product. That might be true. Once the data has been collected and it's sitting somewhere in your lab and your product development folks are poking around with it and, you know, running experiments on it, obviously those experiments don't need to be assessed for the security of the product that collected this data. The question becomes, is the collection of telemetry data itself a function of the product and therefore RDPS?
Yeah. And I will go and say that it doesn't matter, because if your product is sending telemetry data to another server, that is definitely a function of the product. That's undisputable. Well, I'm sure people can dispute it, but I would say it's fairly clear. And let's say that your product would be doing that in clear text, then there is a product level risk that telemetry data, which probably contains some sensitive user information, is exposed to the public internet. And therefore, at the product level, you would need to do something to secure that telemetry system. Maybe there's a little hole where it does matter whether this is RDPS, like the collection of telemetry overall is RDPS or not, in the extent to which the CRA requires you to secure the server that sits on the other side of this connection that receives the telemetry. Maybe. But the spirit of the law is in any case quite clear that you need to protect that telemetry data channel so that it does not leak sensitive information.
We hope. That is our interpretation, and I think that is a sound, reasonable interpretation. I would also say that this discussion of telemetry data, which has been going on for a year, this particular example has up and down, back and forth. Originally, the idea was like, well, anything that just exports data, any kind of data, anything that's one way, a one-way transfer between the product and some remote service should not be considered IPS. And I'm glad that that has no longer the case. But I think this is the safest version. This is sort of the test argument for the exfiltration of any data from a product for future product development. The issue here, as far as I can tell, is that we don't have a clear definition of telemetry data here, and we don't have a clear definition of future product development. And by having this example here, I worry that people are going to think, I don't need to do anything to secure the personal data that I'm taking out of my product, other than what maybe the GDPR requires or some other laws require. Because that's the other thing. There are other laws on regarding what you can do with personal data, but they aren't about how secure the product has to be.
Some similar topic that's related to all of this is also that there is a recital in the CRA. I forgot the number. What is it? Recital 11 or 12?
If it's about RDPS, it's either 11 or 12.
Which talks a bit about the extent that the RDPS requirements apply to the manufacturer's compute infrastructure. Right. It says that the notion of RDPS and the requirements on RDPS are not intended to entail technical, operational, or organizational measures aiming to manage the risks posed to the security of a manufacturer's networks and information systems as a whole. So what that says is it's not because you as a manufacturer, you're selling a product that somehow communicates with your information systems, that therefore the entirety of your information system, including your corporate email system or your calendaring system, that all of that is under CRA. One thing that remains very underspecified is the extent to which operational questions regarding actually the part of your infrastructure that clearly are RDPS are in scope. Let's take the photo app example. So you're running a photo app, you have a remote data storage solution, which qualifies as an RDPS. You will need to have, or you will implicitly have a policy that specifies which of your employees are able to log in or log on to that service and view your customers' pictures. Like either you will have thought about this and you will have set up a policy, or you will not have thought about this and it will be an implicit policy just based on who can do what. And the question that I have not seen answered is the management of this policy and the technical mechanisms to make sure that only a very limited set of people in your company can access your customer data. Is that part of the RDPS requirements or not? Like under the CRA, is it fine that your chef who works in the cafeteria can view your customers' pictures or not?
So I don't have a direct answer for that because I agree. It's something that we don't see a great deal of discussion of, and we have not seen addressed. But I think it speaks to this larger friction within the Cyber Resilience Act, which is that because of the nature of software, and particularly software as a service, and, well, I guess RDPS, and the sort of iterative design process and the constant redevelopment and the updates and just the way these products are used, the idea of pure product regulation, which is what the CRA insists it is, doesn't fit easily with the realities of software and of technology. If you purchase a pan, which is CE marked, it is very clear whether that pan's handle will catch fire when exposed to your induction stovetop and whether or not it's CRA compliant. Or not CRA compliant because it's a pan, it's not, but you know, is CE compliant. It is far less clear if the manufacturer could rush in at any time and swap the pan handle out effectively. And I think it'd be even more unclear is if the manufacturer, and maybe my metaphor has broken down here, but if the manufacturer was controlling how hot the stove was at the same time as you were, you know, placing it and everything else, you know, the ability for the manufacturer to constantly be involved with the product after it's been passed on to the consumer means that there needs to be some process requirements, I think.
And this is actually a bigger picture problem because The CRA is based on this thing called the NLF, the New Legislative Framework. I believe that we've mentioned that before, but that's the larger framework that governs all product safety regulation in the EU. So it's the framework that governs CE marking. And that framework is quite old. And in many things that you see in the framework and in the snippets that are then reused to create the various laws under the framework, including the CRA, you see that it hasn't quite caught up yet with the modern reality of how products are built and continuously redeveloped and receive updates and might remain under control of the manufacturer, etc. Like all of those notions are not really in there. And that's why when you start thinking about questions relating from that modern reality, you often find that the law does not provide adequate answers, or you need to do a whole lot of interpretation.
I think as a whole for the CRA, this is a quagmire, but when it comes to remote data processing, it's absolutely the worst there because it is the most continuously under the manufacturer's control. I mean, that gets us to our second requirement here, which is that the product must be designed and developed by or on behalf of the manufacturer and is the responsibility of the manufacturer.
So the RDPS, right? So
yeah, the RDPS. I'm sorry, the RDPS.
So
I say the product, it is also the RDPS is the product again.
Yeah. But in order for remote data processing to qualify as an RDPS, the software used for the data processing must be developed by or on behalf of the manufacturer. And I think this is...
under the responsibility of the manufacturer.
Yeah. What I think is quite interesting here is that it does not actually matter who operates it. So if you're a manufacturer of a product and you create a remote data processing service, but then you delegate the operation of that to a subcontractor, then that is still RDPS. But conversely, if let's say you have a product that supports remote update functionality, and in order to run that remote update server, you do not write your own remote update system, but instead you buy something which you then run and operate on premises, then because that remote update server software, because you bought it and you didn't write it yourself, that means that that component, that remote component, actually is not an RDPS, even though you as the manufacturer, you are running and operating it.
I have a real interjection that I need to raise here, which is that you keep mentioning a product that the manufacturer themselves creates. I think it is really important because I suspect it might be more common in this case where the product is the RDPS is ultimately being operated by a third party, for that RDPS to be designed and developed by that third party as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is that it is still RDPS if it is designed and developed on behalf of the manufacturer, which I think raises interesting questions about how much transparency, how much insight the manufacturer has into it, and gets into the question of, is it the responsibility of the manufacturer? Because imagine you had a custom, keep it secure update. You had a custom platform designed for your secure updates. You contracted with a third party to do that. They're going to run it for you afterwards, but it clearly is your design, but you don't own it. They maintain the rights to it because they created it. How do you get enough information to perform a CRA assessment on it? I'm not saying it's impossible. I think there are plenty of ways to do it, but it's something you need to start thinking about when you're writing that contract with that provider.
And this also touches on this question that I deal with a lot, and that is when you, as a manufacturer, you outsource some development and you request a custom service or product from a third party, when is that you as a manufacturer just outsourcing a development service and you remain completely responsible for everything that subcontractor does? And when does the thing that you buy actually become a product placed on the market for which your subcontractor is responsible for making sure that it's CRA compliant, and you as a manufacturer, you only have your due diligence requirements?
And the EC guidance had some guidance here. Unfortunately, it kind of goes over my head, because in one place it says that the RDPS that is, off the shelf, I guess it's not an RDPS at that point, the remote service that is off the shelf that is not designed and developed specifically for the manufacturer, by which they mean really designed and developed specifically for the manufacturer, is not RDPS. It's something else. It's a service that is performing functions of the product maybe, but is treated as a component, or is even treated in some cases as a part of the larger product environment, a dependency. Yet at the same time, there's also some discussion of if you have a platform that you've, you know, platform as a service that you have contracted for, and then you are running your own software over that. That software that you're running and running remotely over that platform is an RDPS. To me, this is a little hard to parse, and maybe I just don't, you know, computers are still a vast, vague nest of wires in my head that I don't really understand.
So the guidance talks about this quite a bit. So it talks about whether when you buy infrastructure as a service or platform as a service or software as a service, whether those various things qualify as RDPS. And again, it's one of those examples, as so often with the CRA, where it's very clear on the extrema what the interpretation is, but there is a big fuzzy transition somewhere in the middle. So what the guidance says is that when you're just buying infrastructure as a service and then you're using that to run your own thing, right? Then that is clearly RDPS. So for example, when you go to, let me use a European example. So let's say that you go to Hetsnap and you rent 20 servers from them. And then on that servers, you run your own OS, you run your own software stack, and you use all of that to provide, let's stick with the remote update service. Then that is clearly, like, all of that software is part of the RDPS, because you as a manufacturer, you have put all of that together. You have taken a bunch of components and you've composed them in such a way to create a piece of software that then qualifies as RDPS. On the other hand, if you would buy a completely ready remote update server and you would run that, particularly if you buy it as a service, then that would not be an RDPS, because that is not something that is developed on or of behalf of the manufacturer, because there was no development effort there. There was at most a configuration effort. However, the question that this raises is how much customization and development effort triggers this criteria that something was developed by or on behalf of the manufacturer. In the middle, you can imagine that there is some complicated platform solution that you configure by writing Turing Compute Python code, which can then become incredibly complex. At what point does something move from just configurating something that you bought to developing something yourself?
And, you know, I think the section of the guidance that starts getting into this is, you know, 195, but and it says, you know, there's this very clear statement, right? That's in the bottom last sentence of 195. It says, under the responsibility of the manufacturer entails that the software is built solely by or on behalf of the manufacturer based on designs and specifications provided by it. Which sounds really strong, right? That's, you know, solely is in there. That's a very, very tough word. But, you know, based on specifications provided by it. That's what. How much is that? Is that, as you said, where exactly do we draw that line? And I think that's still up for debate. And I think it's going to be up for debate for a long time.
And the tricky thing is, so this is a question that I've been dealing with a bunch of my clients as well. And it's extremely hard to draw a single line in it, because often even when you look at one individual case, you can model reality in different ways. So it can already be hard to agree on what exactly is happening in that one scenario. But then every single scenario that you look at will have its own specificities and things that kind of suddenly change the balance towards one interpretation or the other interpretation, or bring up something that you really had not thought of before, which made the thing that you worked out for the one case completely not work out for the other case. And there's just such a giant design space there and how you can set up these systems and collaborations that it's extremely hard to make any sort of generalized statement about how this should work.
Well, doesn't that just get us to the third part of this? And then we can go back to why you think all of these terrifying vaguenesses and this void of meaning that we're telling you exists in RDPS still, why that doesn't really matter. So really quick, the third one, and maybe this is in some ways, it's not the easiest one, but maybe it's the biggest, you know it when you see it sort of one, sort of element here, is the product's data processing is happening at a distance. And if it's not happening at a distance, it can't be RDPS. It's just the product. Well, I mean, it's still just the product, it's RDPS, but it's not RDPS, which does have some specific requirements, at least in the standards and different things you have to be concerned about, perhaps, because there's intrinsic risks to moving data around.
This notion of at a distance has also changed significantly over the last year and year and a half, right? So it really went through a journey. I believe that in the beginning, a lot of people were interpreting this as when you have a product and it comes with an app, then that app would be an RDPS.
Well, you have an app and then the app has some online backend.
Yeah, but I believe at some point the prevailing interpretation was that, let's say that you're selling a microwave and the microwave has an app or a washing machine. Let's stick with washing machine. I like washing machines.
That's true. I like a washing machine too. I don't like dirty clothes.
Yeah. So let's say that you have that washing machine and the washing machine comes with an app. For a while, the leading interpretation was that that app is an RDPS for the washing machine. These days, nobody thinks that anymore because the argument
is... I really just want to read CRA guidance 8.11185, the notion of at a distance.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it really kind of captures this whole thing better than I can. And it's authoritative. I mean, this is coming directly from the European Commission. And it's telling you the same kind of, well, wishy-washy kind of confusion that I'm expressing. It says, the notion of at a distance, referred to in Article 3.2, again, the definition of RDPS, is relevant but not sufficient to determine whether a product with digital elements includes RDPS. Furthermore, given the variety of solutions that might fall under this concept, it is not possible to provide an exhaustive definition of at a distance. A case-by-case assessment by the manufacturer is needed. And it goes on a little bit more and it clarifies it a little bit, but that's kind of where we're at with at a distance, right?
Yeah. But I really want to jump back to my history lesson. Please.
Okay, yes, the history is important.
You interrupted my history lesson. So there was a time where everybody believed that apps would be RDPS. However, now nobody believes it anymore. And now the leading view is that the app is really just either a product on itself or part of the main component of the product. Because when you read the definition of product with digital elements in the CRA, it says that it includes software or hardware components being placed on the market separately. So there the notion now is that this app is a software component, your washing machine will be a hardware component. Those two things are placed on the market separately, arguably, because the washing machine you buy in your washing machine store and the app you will buy in whatever app store, you will download it from a website. So they're placed on the market separately. However, they together form one product. And they're both parts of the product that are doing some form of local processing. So we stepped away from the notion that an app would be a remote data processing solution. And then for a while, there was a very strong push also coming from the commission that said, no. RDPS, it's all about cloud processing. And that's really all that is meant with it, cloud processing. And then we had that for a while. And I believe that in the draft guidance, it actually also said something like this. There was more.
It's moving in that direction.
There was a whole section about remote data processing solution. And for a while, the trend was really that, okay, it's really only about cloud processing. And now we see that in the final guidance, we went back to, you know, maybe it can be all sorts of other things that we cannot even conceptualize of.
Well, here's what the guidance has to say in section 187 that I think, you know, a little bit down from the one that I think really kind of captures this as well, and maybe captures this whole journey that RDPS has taken. It says, it is important to note that RDPS are not necessarily operated on third-party cloud infrastructure. remote data processing running on local servers on the manufacturer's premises can constitute RDPS. In other words, a solution run on-premises and on a private cloud is just as likely to qualify as RDPS as a solution run on a public cloud and off-premises.
And then we get also in this argument that we touched on a bit before we hit record, where let's say that you have a manufacturer that provides data processing but doesn't run it on their premises, but provides a box to the customer's premises, so to the user's premises, and then operates that as a managed service.
And this is pretty common as, for example, with SIEM systems, with security information systems.
Yeah, then is this potentially an RDPS or not? Like, there's a whole bunch of questions there. But maybe this is an excellent moment to come back to my hot take that all of these questions that we're asking, it doesn't really matter. Should we go there?
I think we should. I mean, I think one of the things to remember, yeah, I think we should go there. There's nothing to remember here. This is that RDPS is something that is going to be argued about for a long time.
Okay, so let me explain my hot take then. The basic notion, and the notion that really matters, is that the boundary of your product does not end at either the boundaries of the physical product, like the washing machine that you ship, or the binary that you ship if it's a software product. But if you have other parts of your product, whether that is an app, whether that is a cloud service, whether that is something else, as a manufacturer of the product, you need to manage all the risks resulting from all of those things. What the definition of RDPS does, particularly by having this notion in there that something needs to be developed by or on behalf of the manufacturer, it says that only for those parts of the product, you have the full set of manufacturer obligations for that product component. However, the guidance also always says, and actually summarizes this very well in figure 9, that whenever something does not qualify as an RDPS, you as a manufacturer are still responsible for managing the risks that stem from that for your product. Right? And it says also in a couple of places that even though you do not have manufacturer responsibilities for a component, you still have to do your due diligence, which can mean like checking that the cloud service that you're using actually is operated reasonably secure, for example, by asking for their ISO 27000 certificate or something like that.
It can be by shifting, you know, within the contract with you have with them, it can be shifting liability in there too and saying that they need to, you know, perform certain security functions.
Yeah. And the way that I like to shortcut this entire discussion about whether something is RDPS and what exactly that means is to just think of your product that you sell as a manufacturer that you are responsible for, you need to manage all of those risks. And that product will consist of a local component, which will consist of some hardware, potentially some hardware and some software. It might consist of a cloud component, which will also include some software some software, which you may or may not have written, which will run somewhere. And regardless of whether you're looking at that local part of your product or the remote part, your software is always, like, you will always have components that you source as third-party components, and you will have components that you have developed yourself as a manufacturer. So when you're talking about the washing machine, for example, that washing machine is going to have code that runs on a microcontroller. That microcontroller is a third-party component. You have due diligence obligations for it. The code that you run on the microcontroller, probably you wrote yourself. It might also include some components for which you have due diligence obligations. But the part that you wrote yourself, you have full manufacturer obligations for. When you're thinking about your cloud solution, regardless of how you set it up, there are going to be certain parts of that that you as a manufacturer, you have written yourself, or that you have full manufacturer obligations. And then there are going to be other parts of that which you sourced in, like third-party components. For example, if you wrote your own software update server and you run that on some Hetzner infrastructure, then that Hetzner infrastructure is a third-party component. You do your due diligence for that. For the software that you wrote yourself, you have full manufacturer obligations. If the thing that you run on that Hetzner node is not something that you wrote yourself, but something that you just bought. You need to do due diligence of, or you have your due diligence obligations for that, and you need to make sure that you manage the risks that stem from how you configure it, and you need to make sure that you configure it in the secure way. So, yeah, so in the end, it just means as a manufacturer, you are responsible that your product is secure. For the things that you develop yourself, you have full obligations, full manufacturer obligations. For the rest, you need to do your due diligence, and you need to consider all the risks that come from integrating that component.
And there's another third category of things, of remote services, that you have a different, slightly different level of duty around as a manufacturer. And that is even remote services that are not necessary for the functioning of the product are still treated as external dependencies, which in the context of CRA means that there still needs to be some discussion of them in the risk assessment and some information about how risks associated with them may exist, or, and if they do exist, how you've mitigated them through what the CRA describes as product level controls.
Yeah. And I think that's the one thing that we identified in this podcast, which honestly I had not thought of before, but where there might be a small gap in these obligations that you have as a manufacturer, depending on how you interpret things and depending on whether something qualifies as RDPS. But probably in reality, that doesn't matter because you will, I'm not a GDPR expert, but I assume that there is some clause in GDPR saying that you need to treat your customer or personal data securely. Again, there could be a carve out for that when you're not collecting personal data, but data that's still sensitive to an organization for some reason. But then there's a very good chance that you fall under NIST too, and you have those obligations. So there are multiple...
Even other regulations as well.
Yeah, you would need to fall through multiple holes and multiple various regulations before you don't have to do something, or before you don't have obligations. And also, in the grand scheme of things, it is probably going to be a lot easier to just, you know, get your shit on order rather than to worry about whether you can justify an exemption in this very specific case.
Trying to trace that legal path in this environment where the law is not yet clearly defined, and I don't just mean the CRA 2 here. I mean NAS 2 is still being, you know, there are still relatively major European Union members that haven't even translated NAS 2 into their laws. It's in effect, but, you know, and so trying to figure out and take these guesses and these leaps to somehow get around making sure that, you know, you're not transferring people's personal data in plain text or whatever is not, it's just not worth your time.
It's not positive lead resistance. So
it's a fun little mental experiment for compliance experts or lawyers or, you know, people with really sinister mustaches. I don't know. But it's not. Yeah, it's not worth anyone's time, really. And I think you know, I largely agree with your assessment here, Pete, that I've cared a lot about RDPS over time because I saw it as a real place where the CRA could do a lot of good things. And I think most of my concerns have been answered in a very positive way by the ultimate interpretation of it. I would also suggest that one of the places you can see interesting implementations of RDPS, if you go to those ETSI standard drafts that we mentioned, one of the late processes in a standardization effort, vertical standardization effort, was trying to create a kind of cross-vertical, maybe a mini horizontal, well, we're not supposed to say that, but a cross-vertical effort to define RDPS protections and RDPS measures, mitigations, or technical measures that you can take to have secure RDPS. And part of doing that, and this is where I think comes back to what we're talking about here, in part of doing that, there was a lot of discussion, and this I was still quite involved in this discussion, about how we look at RDPS and how we look at the functions. Because obviously, if you're talking about it being any function of the product, and you're trying to connect it to this specific vertical of a specific kind of product, there's going to be functions that could be done on RDPS that you still then apparently need to comply full assessment for, that you can't give all those technical requirements for, because they're just outside of the scope of that vertical. So what ended up generally happening, and I think this is still reflected in Annex R, is usually where this shared annex, shared understanding of RDPS will be. I will also note that some of the other, some of the verticals have gone their own way with RDPS and have tried to incorporate it in their general set of technical requirements. So that's fascinating. But Annex R takes the approach where it doesn't really look at what the remote data processing solution does and assumes that will either be covered by the functionalities of the, you know, the mitigations around the functionalities of the product. You know, if there's storage being done by the RDPS, there will be requirements covered by storage. Those will apply to the remote version as well. It only looks at the sort of intrinsic risks, because we're talking about risk and use case based standards, of the RDPS, which is to say the idea that you have data coming in and out and moving over some form of network, public or private, and what mitigations you might have to take to protect against risks associated with that. So within the sort of boundary of the interfaces, that is all the RDPS requirement looks at. And it's quite fascinating. I mean, it's, you know, maintaining the integrity of that data in transit, maintaining that integrity of the data when it arrives, and making sure that it doesn't disrupt it and things like that. But it's not really that in depth. And I don't think that's a bad way to approach it, because what you're really looking at, I think it's the only way you can approach it. What you're really looking at is RDPS is a particular kind of function of its own, which is to say it is moving things around in a way that maybe the product doesn't have to, or the product chooses to. Mm-hmm. So it has its own very distinct set of risks. Those can be addressed, but they can be addressed through assessment, they can be addressed through due diligence, or they can be addressed through just treating as a dependency, depending on what it is. And you're going to generally, as long as the product is self-secure, and as long as the moving the data in and out of it is secure, it's going to be sufficient. It's going to be a secure product, I would hope. At least that's my understanding of it.
I would also say, and I say that not having looked at the RDPS Annex or Annex R in a while, that actually what you are describing, that actually was in it when I looked at it and is still in it. So this discussion about how do you secure data while it is in transit, that based on what I was saying before, and also what the guidance says, that you should probably do those things regardless of whether or not the thing sitting on the other end of the connection qualifies as RDPS, which again points to the fact that, you know, it doesn't really matter whether something is RDPS or not. You just need to build your product securely and focus your energy on that rather than finding weird legal loopholes.
One potential issue is if it's RDPS, maybe you should do those things on both ends. But, even if it's not, you should make sure the people that are on the other end are doing those things. So, yeah, it's all the same in the wash. To get back to washing machines, it all comes out.
Okay, we have been talking for way too long again.
Way, way too long. I'm falling asleep here. It's late at night. The children have all gone home from outside. They've stopped doing construction work. The neighborhood has gone quiet. It's just my voice echoing throughout the courtyard as I talk about remote data processing. So I have to stop ruining my neighbor's day.
I'm just thinking of the various topics that I wanted to discuss in this podcast that we didn't even get to.
I know. Maybe it's RDPS 2. It's coming. Maybe we get someone who worked on the Annex, or someone who suffers from excessive association with cloud solutions, or something like that. Someone panicking about RDPS. We can find someone to talk to.
That would be good. But for now, let's just close with the notion that whether something is RDPS or not, it doesn't really matter. You just need to make sure that your product is secure, and that does not only include the local components. Can we close on that note?
I think we can close on that note.
Let's do it.
Have a wonderful evening, Pete.
Same to you. Bye, August.
Bye.